Hello, everybody. Welcome to the New in Chess podcast. My name is Dirk-Jan ten Geusendam, which for good reasons is often shortened to DJ. The New in Chess podcast is brought to you by DGT, the leading producer of chess clocks and sensory boards that are used in major and minor competitions all around the world. Today, my guest is Grandmaster Anish Giri, the number one Dutch chess player and one of the finest and most popular chess players in the world. Anish is also one of the most many-sided players around. His online presence has brought him hundreds of thousands of followers. He has produced highly successful chessable courses, and of course, he's a contributing editor to New in Chess magazine. Anish has kindly accepted our invitation to look ahead to the Candidates Tournament in Toronto that will kick off on April 3rd and will no doubt keep us captivated the next 3 weeks. Anish, hello. Thanks for joining us. How are you doing?
Thank you. Thank you for the invitation. Doing great.
You're doing great. Well, you're a busy man. You're involved in many projects. Was there one that definitely should have been mentioned when I briefly summed up your activities?
No, thank you very much. No, I don't think so. Mostly, if you still mention that I play chess professionally, then I'm feeling good enough. For the rest, the rest is currently still sort of side gigs at the moment. Still trying to play professionally, still trying to achieve the highest goals.
Yeah. Well, your main over the board event this year was Wagon's Ace so far. As the defending champion, you played well and you tied for first. And then he prevailed and he took the title. What are the main tournaments? I mean, both over the board and online that you will play this year?
I got invited to the Grand Chess Tour, which is still, a big fixture in the chess calendar. So I'm going to participate in that. And of course, there are some other tournaments along the way. Of course, there's always like a team event. This year is the Olympiad again, which is something to look forward to, definitely. Very exciting event. And they come occasionally, invites of some other big tournaments. You have a lot of rapid tournaments nowadays. Just today, got contacted from the Global Chess League. Is this big team event, Rapid, I believe. And yeah, there are many tournaments popping up. I must say that I find it's very unprofessional the way we have the calendar. It's also, at some point, I was also thinking, well, what if I was a tournament organizer myself? And I just wouldn't know how to do it because you can't... you need, time to secure the players, to secure everything. And the calendar is so vague. I mean, at the start of this year, it looked like there are zero tournaments. But then you know that, again, it will be full of events. They will be clashing with each other. But they are announced also late. So it's hard to say right now if I have Grand Chess Tour Olympiad. But I'm sure more events are going to come up as we go.
Yeah. Well, it's always been a problem in the chess world, having a clear calendar. Is that something that has gotten more complicated now that there's so many big online tournaments? They have their own agenda to a certain extent.
Yeah, I don't know. I think the tournament maybe was always there, but it starts to, it keeps sort of drop by drop. And at some point it starts to annoy me more and more. And now when I start to think about issues around the chess, only because when I was a kid, I was only thinking about the moves, the chess moves and nothing outside of it, really. And now, I also have to think about or just think, as I get older, I speak to more people, to organizers, I speak to sponsors and, I read about other sports and sort of start thinking about things more generally and broadly. And then I noticed that, let's actually, it's abnormal the way the calendar is. And it's very, very inconvenient as well for me in particular now, of course. Because I have to plan things more ahead, yeah. And it's not good, and I don't really understand also why that is. Because I think it would be better for everyone. Also, like, let's say if you're an event organizer, you want your event secured, right? But I don't know exactly why that happens. Why you can't really secure a calendar a year upfront? Because most of the time it's the same events that keep coming back.
Yes, well, if you've given it some thought, you probably also have thought of possible solutions. Where, in what direction were you thinking? How can this be solved?
Well, I didn't really think that far, honestly. it's just sort of an issue there. I mean, I can imagine that some tournaments, they can't secure the funding. That must be the only main reason. Because if you have the funding secured, but actually it's a problem that, you know, it's a problem, it's like a loop. Because of uncertainty of calendar, the tournaments are unable to schedule. So like it would resolve on its own if everybody had agreed to let's just schedule everything.
Yeah.
So it's maybe a communication issue between organizers perhaps. Because yes, again, if you want to do a tournament next year, you cannot schedule it because you're afraid that it will clash with other tournaments that also cannot schedule it because they're also afraid of the clash. Everybody is afraid of the clash. Nobody's scheduling anything.
Yeah.
Until there is no more time left, and then they schedule it all at once. So yeah, we're always managing and it's always fine. But it's, I guess also as the chess sort of gets a little bit bigger and goes slightly more into mainstream, these things will also naturally, hopefully will get better. All the organizational issues. For example, also you see now, I think a lot, a big consequence of like chess going slightly more mainstream is that issues, potential issues with the game are much more vocally addressed. Yeah, like one is of course this whole cheating business, but also, for example, some, you know, it comes up like the question of like arranged draws, you know, comes up like because it's been there for in chess for so long, but suddenly now it's being noticed and people are like, hang on a second, you know, like what's the whole thing with arranged draws and why are we allowing that to happen? Yeah. And also the stuff at the World Rapid and Blitz where Nepo and Dubov suddenly got punished for their arranged draw, you know, these kind of things. Like I think like as chess sort of grows, it's gradually should gets more professional, hopefully.
Yeah, well, you would assume that all the big parties that are involved, that they should realize that they should discuss this with each other. They should be on one page and that it would benefit all of them. And you feel that this is not happening at the moment.
I think it's also normal. Like you have also many things where like top players, if they communicated more, it would improve. But it's like this sort of, like in game theory, yeah, you have that situation where I think it's the prisoner's dilemma or whatever, one of those game theory dilemmas where you would be all better off if you communicate, but since you are competitors, you don't want to be the one who gives in ground first. Yeah, so yeah. That's why I guess tournaments, they're also competing with each other, so they don't want to be the first one to blink, and yeah, the communication is not big, but it's not a huge issue. I mean, it's everything is still going very well, and yeah. And like the big events, of course, like the candidates and the match, they are announced up front, so it's more in the details, yeah. But yeah, let's say it is kind of funny that at the start of the year I had literally zero tournaments, and now when things are popping up, it's again clear that my schedule will be overcrowded, which is which is unfortunate.
Yeah, well, you mentioned the candidates tournament, and of course that's the tournament we decided to talk about. I'm well, no doubt, not the only chess fan who will badly miss you there. I mean, you were well on your way to qualify. And then there were some remarkable last-minute developments. How disappointed are you not to be there?
Yeah, of course I'm very disappointed, especially because I had very good chances for a large part of the year. And it's always harder when you're closer. And in general, I guess your feelings, you know, it's like a reality minus the expectations. Yeah, so if the reality is better than the expectation, you're happy. If the reality is worse than the expectation, you're unhappy. It's not so much about the reality, but yeah, given the way the year went, and I started on a high with the Vikan Zay tournament, and then there were many other highlights through the year where I was collecting the circuit points, especially the Grand Suisse tournament in Isle of Man. That was something I was really thrilled about. I was very fortunate. It was going very, very you know, it was not going very well. Hmm. And the last three, I think I won the last three games, which was very unexpected for me.
Mm-hmm.
And that really changed things around, and I got some crucial points. So I was really looking forward definitely to qualify through that path. But at the same time, of course, you'll know that it's a tournament with eight players, and there are more than eight good players out there. So it's no wonder that anybody could suddenly miss out.
Yeah. But did you think that it was pretty unfortunate how things evolved in the last month? I mean, did this, with the rules as they were, it could have been predicted that something like this would happen, and which would definitely damage the interests of, well, in this case, you and Wesley. So
yes, and one I mean, that was definitely indeed predictable, so I definitely saw it coming. I think the main reason that I lost my candidate spot was not that this event was staged last minute. I don't think it was as last minute as it seemed. It was registered very late, the tournament that Kukesh won in the end. But I think I heard about this idea for months, actually, that there's going to be a tournament in India. So it was not a surprise to me. But I think it was very unexpected that Kukesh won it, given his form. And it's a tremendous achievement on his part. So congratulations to him. But I think it was very unlikely that he would have won. And the main reason he is in the candidates is not that the tournament was created, but I think that he won that tournament. So I think, yes, it's very, very unfortunate for me, because I don't think it was likely that he would win this tournament. But I think he did. And we both had a lot of tournaments. There was a certain system. And overall, it made some sense. I think this year they've adjusted the system, and it already looks much more strange to me, because I think after the first tournament of the year, the winner of the challengers had more points than people who shared first, fourth in the Masters.
Oh, really?
Which is quite... I mean, not all the people. I think the winner of the Tata Steel on tiebreak has more points. And then comes, I think, the winner of the challengers, and then comes the people who shared first, fourth, so the other three. So it's kind of something definitely wrong with that system. If a player would hesitate whether she should participate in the challengers by refusing invitation to the Masters, and try to win the event instead of going for the only first place. So it's a little bit strange, and I guess it's. I guess they just got the math wrong. I think I have a feeling they don't really. I don't know. They say they have these simulations and stuff and mathematicians, but I have a feeling these days very often people mention that they consult mathematicians, but they actually don't do that. I think they just think with their own head and don't really test their hypothesis well enough, because we see how the system doesn't work in the very first tournament of the year, then clearly it wasn't well tested up front.
Yeah. Well, you said that you were surprised by the fact that Gukesh won the tournament, that it was an achievement on his part. Did you consider taking, was that the reason that you didn't consider taking countermeasures and trying to play something additionally yourself in December?
First of all, it's very hard for me to arrange that, because, as I like to joke, I'm a professional. So if you're a professional, you cannot just make up events. I have schedule. There's a time when I train. There's time where I play. I'm not sort of just making up just tournaments. I did consider. Well, between the London tournament that he played and the one in India, he played two, in fact, right? So the London he did very badly. The London was a much easier tournament, so I expected him to win that, actually. He was by far the first seed, and it was really very much a field that he could handle, I thought. And after that tournament, there was an event. There was even a possibility to play European Rapid Championship. And if I would have won European Rapid Championship unshared, I would gain like a milli point on the on the circuit, and that would put me ahead of Gukesh had he won the London. So there was some kind of thing like that. There was also the Sitges tournament. So I could have played those, but that was only what I would have done had he won the London event. But he didn't do that. And after London, I was still ahead. And then I chose not to play neither the European nor the Sitges. And then after Sitges, finished the Indian event. And after the Indian tournament finished, then there was nothing more for me to play. I had the World Rapid and Blitz, but it was Of course, I mean, actually, I even had realistic chances in the World Rapid. I think on the final day, I had to win all my four games, and actually, I managed to win the first two. Second one was with black. So then I was having a third game with white, and if I had won that game and I had chances, I would only need to win one more game with black, which is, you know, like it's of course very hard, but compared to like a goal that seems unattainable at the start, if you already win three, to only win the last one is much more possible. Also, you've got all the self-belief is there at that point. So I did have some chances to overtake him, even though in the World Rapid, but realistically, they're not big. Though at the same time, I think in general, in sports, also in chess, usually you have to accomplish something where the chances of that happening are not very big. And that's what sort of great results are made of.
Yeah.
So it was probably possible, but didn't happen.
Yes. Well, we agreed to speak about the candidates as they are now, and to have a look at the eight players who are going to compete there and who are going to fight for the right to challenge Ding Liren at the end of the year. Shall we go through the list the other way around? So starting with the bottom seed and then working our way up. Is that okay with you?
Yeah, it makes sense, sure.
Yeah, so first we have Nijat Abbasov from Azerbaijan, who was clearly the weakest candidate, but who was also the one who ruined your World Cup chances. What do you think his role will be in the tournament? What are your expectations there?
Yeah, he's a strong grandmaster. Definitely a strong grandmaster. He's been playing at a reasonably high level for many, many years already. I think he may be a little bit younger than me, maybe a year or two, not more.
Yeah, he's 28. Yeah,
basically, you know, more or less my age at this point. And he's been around, he's a 2600 for a few years already. Hasn't dropped below that, I think. Like his level is kind of steady. The World Cup was a slight outlier. He finished fourth, I think, in the World Cup, which is nice, you know. But it's possible. I mean, let's say I contributed to that. I lost my match. My own fault there. And after that, still he needed a few more accomplishments. But it was possible, you know. The field was sort of, you know, he didn't have to beat Carlsen or Nakamura or, you know, like that.
Yeah, one reason was clearly because Carlsen didn't claim his spot, so he...
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah. And even despite getting fourth, he still had to have that fall his way. So he sort of qualified, it wasn't a huge accomplishment for him, and it's great he did it, but of course it's sort of, you could say, barely qualified. After that he played again a few tournaments and he stayed on the same level as before the tournament, so there's no big change in his play, his level, so there's no reason to think that he will perform differently than a 2600 rated player should perform in a field like that. So he should be a big underdog. I think he'll be an even bigger underdog, and I think he will be, because he when you play the candidates, you are sort of supposed to fight for the first place, right? Because that's sort of your once in a lifetime opportunity and all that.
Yeah.
And if you start playing, let's say, for draw with white pieces, that just isn't very smart. Yeah. Because even if you achieve all your dream and you'll get your 50%, maybe even if you get lucky somewhere, you win one game somehow. You know, you'll finish on plus one. Maybe you get so lucky you finish plus, but you're not going to win the tournament basically with that approach. So to try and win the tournament, you have to play for winning at least with the white pieces. I guess if he does that and he'll have 14 fighting games against top players, I mean, he has to score a massive minus. I don't see.
Yeah.
I mean, that would be logical. The way I see the situation.
Is it annoying to have one player in the field who, well, let's say theoretically has few chances to win, but he can be a spoil sport. He can, I mean, you may trip up against exactly that player. And
no, but I think it's amazing. I think that's actually, at some point also I was thinking, you know, the FIDE has created the cycle and they've randomized everything to largest possible extent. And then I realized that maybe actually, I don't know if they did it on purpose, but actually maybe that's smart, because in fact, you don't really want to have candidates where you have like the top eight of the world facing each other, especially in the modern times with modern preparation. That could really be a very, very close event with very, very little intrigue and plot twists, where, you know, the smallest margins will decide, you know, somebody will mix up the prep in one of the 14 games by accident, whatever, and each half point, you know, will be crucial. I think it's much better when the field is mixed, and you see that also in Vikings. I think that's a recipe for a wonderful tournament, because already at the start, everybody knows, let's say, when you face round one, somebody's going to face Nijat, let's say, with white.
Yeah.
He knows, you know, he doesn't win that game, he is already an underdog against the field, because he wasted an opportunity there. And that already creates one game where there's one guy who is, in, you know, basically in his head and a must win.
Yeah.
Yeah, because basically, you know, you want to win the candidates, you have white against Nijat. Well, like, what do you want? If you're not going to win that game, what game are you going to win? So that creates directly an imbalance there. And if he wins, which is likely, if he goes all out, you know, whatever, 40% chance that happening, maybe more. If he wins, that creates the imbalance that the others are like, okay, he beat Nijat, not a given that I will beat Nijat also. So maybe I should beat someone else just to be sure. So that immediately creates an imbalance in the tournament, and then there are people chasing each other, and that is what you need actually for a tournament to be entertaining and fun. So I think that's actually wonderful that you have a player like that. Of course, you could say, well, the guy who is like the, let's say, world number, you know, imagine you have seven top world top seven and number 100 of the world, then you'll say, okay, this world number eight, you know, he deserves to be there more than world number 100. But yeah, okay, that's not that's the downside. But I think in general, the fact that Nijat's there will give the tournament a whole new twist. And okay, if you never know. Of course, it could be possible that a miracle happens and he does really well. But it's a tough tournament, yeah.
Yeah, so let's view this from the spectator's perspective, that in fact it's a welcome factor of uncertainty that Nijat Abbasov is there. And let's see how he will do. Maybe... Well, it is a fantastic opportunity for him anyway. Then we get three Indians, Vidit, Gukesh, and Pragnananda. What I thought was totally amazing that in the March FIDE list that they were all three exactly on 2,747 ELO points. I mean, that's quite something to achieve that. So the first one... that I want to hear your opinion about is Vidit Gujarati. He lost some points in the Prague Masters where he didn't do well. Do you think that this may leave traces, or is it, well, the famous saying of a bad dress rehearsal will lead to a great premiere?
Yeah, it's hard to say. Some people, they play really well when they are sort of on a wave, you know, like when things are really going well. So one player like that is Jan Nepomniachtchi. Like, he is the by far the biggest example, right, of a guy who plays really well when on the roll. And very often for players like that, a setback kind of breaks the whole thing completely apart, and it just breaks everything, and then they no longer win tournaments after a setback. Like with Vidit, we just sort of haven't seen yet whether his recent rise, whether it is a product of sort of him evolving into an entirely new player who is stronger than the player that he was. Or whether it is a product of that one very, very long wave that keeps carrying him forward, and whether this Prague tournament is the end of the wave. Because if that's the end of the wave, then there's no, it doesn't look likely it's going to win the candidates. But if you say that Vidit is just sort of evolved, like fundamentally, and is now not anymore like a world number 40 player, but like a world number 20 player, or maybe even higher, whatever, 15 or whatever. And this one tournament was just a setback because, you know, he had to hide his preparation and all of that, and he was testing out more risky things or whatever. Yeah, you can always make up some stuff.
Yeah.
So if that is the case, then yeah, everything is still all right for him.
Yeah.
But it's hard for me to tell because he's actually very fresh and new at this particular height. He's had this very good half a year, almost a year by now. But, you know, we need to see a bit more on him.
Yeah. Well, his result in Isle of Man was truly stunning. In Prague, a couple of games that he lost, I mean, he was doing very well. And then suddenly there was this lapse. I mean, is that a show of vulnerability or can it be simply a matter of form?
Yeah, hard to say. Yeah. When players make such huge blunders in Prague, we saw Vidit and also Pragnanda make this huge blunder. Actually, it was funny because when I played my tournament in Shenzhen, I was losing. At some point, I lost three games in a row. And I think within more or less the same days, Vidit also lost three games in a row. So we lost like six games combined in like 4 days.
Yeah.
Which was interesting. But I felt that, I mean, not to compare, like to compare two different losers, but I felt that sort of the way I lost it was, more normal to me. Like I sort of saw, you know, my bad qualities reflect in my games, and sometimes when you're in bad form or things don't go your way, suddenly all your chess weaknesses come on top, and it is still you, like it's very much you, but it's just it looks just very ugly. But in his case it was different, like you mentioned, it was just lapses of concentration and blunders, and those things, they are much more worrying to me because you don't know where they come from, you don't know why they come, why they go, and I have no idea what happened there. Maybe he had some sort of a burnout type thing, because I imagine that he worked real hard, then played a lot, then again worked real hard. Probably, actually, now that I think of it, maybe he just overworked. I suspect that that's what happened. Like, he just got too tired, because I think he had like Isle of Man, that he knew already the candidates, probably started working very much. Then he had Vikanzai. After Vikanzai, not that much time between, you know, the Prague and candidates, and also he probably went on a training camp. Then he went probably to the tournament straight from the training camp, and it was like too much. I guess it's too intensive.
Yeah. Well, you're the same age. You're both 29. You're good friends. Do you speak to him about his game? I mean, on a private basis, or?
Yeah, sometimes we talk about chess more broadly. Mm. Definitely, yeah. Sometimes we do.
Yeah,
but we have a very different outlook in general on on many things when it comes to chess, which is interesting because then you know you have discussions, you have different points of view, and then you try to learn something from each other.
Yeah. Well, the next Indian player is Gukesh, brilliant player, but also not always stable, as we saw in Isle of Man. What are your expectations of him? I mean, could this be his big moment, or is it too early for that?
Yeah, well, whenever I think of Gukesh, sort of I judge him very strictly. Because he has very high rating, or he had at some point a very high rating, and he's competing already for the very highest of goals, and it's very easy for me to judge him very harsh because I see lots of weaknesses in his play. But then I always have to realize that he is so extremely young.
Yeah, he's 17.
It's still 17. Yeah.
Yeah.
Unbelievable. Yeah. Actually, it's unbelievable that he made it. Already so high, and he's been around also for a while. That's the funny part.
Yeah,
I mean, I played two Vikanzais already with him being a top player. But he was 16, or what you claim, when I played him in Vikanzai last year.
Yeah,
that's unbelievable.
Yeah,
I don't believe it. I'm going to Google right now Gukesh's age. I just don't believe he's 17.
Well, I remember we had him.
Unbelievable. No, you're of course. I know you're right. I just want to see it with my own eyes because I can't believe it. So that's why. I mean, it's kind of ridiculous to talk about his weaknesses when he's 17. Of course, he's going to have weaknesses.
Yeah.
But that said, I mean, I think it's too early, I guess, to win the candidates. I guess. I mean, I don't know. Don't you think? Doesn't he himself think it's early? Or?
I don't know. It's.
Shouldn't be, yeah.
Yeah.
The This podcast is brought to you by DGT, the chess innovators. DGT introduced digital clocks to the chess world at a time when only analog clocks were used. For over 30 years, DGT has been making the official FIDE chess clock, endorsed by the World Chess Federation. DGT clocks are the world's best-selling chess clocks, the standard in chess timing and used everywhere. To find your nearest DGT dealer, please visit our website at dgt.nl.
Well, let's switch to another Indian who is already 18 years old, Pragnananda.
Yes, Prag is.
I think he wouldn't be surprised if he is ready. I mean, he's.
I'd be more surprised.
Yes.
Well, I'd be more surprised with Prag than with Gukesh, to be honest, because I think the Gukesh's results they have much more extremes.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you remember this Olympiad insanity where he did, what was it? Like, I don't even remember.
Yeah,
he did an insane amount.
29 points from 14 games or something. I mean, an awful lot. I mean,
yes. No, he won just everything in a row and then he beat Fabio. And it was like, what, 9 games? No, I don't know how many games. Yeah. It's crazy. 9 games, I think.
It was the gold medal on first board.
Yes. And then he was going to win one more, but he overpressed and lost to Abdusatorov.
Yeah.
I think then just came back and played a good game again. So
yeah.
His highs are much higher. Prague had some insane results in Rapid. Mm. I remember that. Well, he of course had some good tournaments too. Yeah, he won this tournament once. I think was it in Hungary or something. Some close tournament he won quite impressively. But I feel the Prague has matured into a player that I can very much relate to. I understand him. He's become very wise already.
Hmm.
He has a very good sense of danger. He learned a lot from his experience. He played all these tours with Carlsen and everybody else. He played a lot of matches, prepared for them, and was learning from. And I have a feeling that he's he's just very, very good.
Hmm.
And I wouldn't be surprised to see him do very well. But I just don't remember, don't see him right now putting up a large score in a field like that.
Mm-hmm.
Like, well, I don't remember him doing these kind of things, and I don't really picture that. I think he is a little bit too objective, and yeah, he's sort of very correct, you know, as a player.
Mm-hmm.
He's trying to play according to the position. He doesn't burn bridges when he thinks that he doesn't have to burn them. I think he also, whenever he sees that things can go, you know, the tide is turning against him, he does damage control. Like, he does everything right. And I think with such approach, it's difficult to win. Canada is this strong for him at this early age.
But at the same time, he's very self-confident. And also you see that in games where he gets into some trouble, he remains so calm. I mean, he doesn't easily lose control and totally collapse.
Well, I don't think he's that self-confident compared to other young players or some other top players even. I mean, he's obviously confident, but like relative to others, his play... Like, what I mean is, a sign of massive confidence is when, let's say, it's clear for everyone that you're probably worse, and yet you are playing for a win, for example, right?
Yeah.
That means that you're very confident. I never seen that with him. I think when it looks like he's probably worse, he starts to defend, which is correct, and he defends. I don't see him gamble very often. I don't see the signs of some insane confidence, let's say. I think he knows he's good. He trusts himself.
Yeah.
But he's just a very correct player. I think he has a potential to grow into a great player gradually.
Mm-hmm.
But I think that it's going to be very gradual. And I think, you know, it might take many years until Prague gradually fully unleashes into a monstrous player. But right now, I would be surprised if he wins this very candidates.
Yeah. So in fact, you think that both for Gukesh and Prague, the moment has not yet come.
Yeah, I mean, Gukesh, like, sometimes he reaches this insane... Also, he is very streaky. Even in Vikings 8 this year, he lost a couple and then he won a few in a row.
Yeah.
He sometimes, when momentum is with him, because he is the guy who gambles and he is the guy... Largely, you know, a lot of it comes from... Yeah, not even sort of Well, I wouldn't say like ignorance is a bliss, let's say, not to underplay, you know, his greatness.
Mm.
But compared to Prague, let's say, very often he might not realize the dangers that are there.
Yeah.
And that will make him take a more bold and brave approach, you know. It doesn't come from the fact that he is greater than, understands the position greater than Prague would, but
yep.
It comes from the fact that, you know, he's, just less, you know, less cautious and... I see Gukesh, like I can imagine seeing Gukesh suddenly, like, you know, to everybody's shock, like win a bunch of games,
yep.
And then the finish line suddenly is there.
Mm-hmm.
So I could imagine that happen. I find it less likely to imagine Prague crushing this tournament. But I would, let's say, predict Prague finishing with like +2 or something like that.
Okay. Well, that takes us to one of the older players, Jan Nepomniachtchi, who's 33. This would be his, well, if he wins, that would be his third candidates in a row. That would be writing history. Do you think there's any chance that will happen?
Yeah, I think there's a chance that will happen for sure. There's a reason he won the other two,
mm-hmm.
for sure. He's, you know, he's amassed one of the best prep by now, because he's prepared for the candidates, then he prepared for the match, then he prepared for another candidates, then he prepared again for the match.
Mm-hmm.
And each of those milestones, you know, or events, they give you a boost. You have, you know, you get extra energy to prepare. You get the resources to and motivation to collect the team and prepare. Mm-hmm. So he's got like this, you know, he had tremendous preparation. I remember for me, one of my best periods came when the candidates kept being postponed,
mm-hmm.
because for each time the candidates was postponed, I was preparing.
Yeah.
So I would gather my team. We would do a big, big preparation. So instead of preparing for one candidate, I was lucky. I prepared for three. So I got three for the price of one. But Jan, he's got two candidates and two matches.
Yeah.
And now he's got a candidate again, and he's again motivated. So everything is well. I think for Jan, if he doesn't win the candidates, then I'm very curious how his chess career will look like for the rest, because that will suddenly kick him out of his usual loop, and I think, yeah, that's a good loop to be in. And once he's out, I wonder where he will channel motivation at this point. Right now I think he's looking pretty good still.
So you mean that, in fact, more than anyone else in the chess world, he has been fully involved in the world championship cycle the past years. I mean, that was his mainstay. And because he has done it twice, he might even do it three times. Well, despite the big pressure that he will feel in Russia.
No, I mean, seriously, no, I don't think.
You don't think so?
No, I mean, I think Jan knows that. No, but like pressure in Russia, that's. I don't think he thinks in that stuff. You think that Jan thinks that the Russia now is currently the whole country is watching him play the candidates, and like I don't think
the Russian players they are kind of isolated at the moment, so I guess that the leadership in the federation, that they would very much like him to see to do well, maybe more than before. I don't know.
I don't know him very well, but the way I see him, I think that aspect of it is just not really on his mind.
Yeah, you mean he can isolate himself from that?
Yeah. I think that he just absolutely doesn't care what his government thinks about.
Yeah.
In particular about his candidate chances.
Is that something that might play a role for Prague? Because I think he's probably the most popular young Indian in his country, with a lot of support. I mean, both government support and sponsor support. Will that be a problem for him, that the expectations are so high?
He seems very relaxed about that. I think he's kind of grew into fame, you know, from a young age. He was always the one in some sense. I think the media always named him as the one. You know, whenever he was about to not be the one, then he would always deliver.
Yeah.
And, my impression of him is that he is an extremely, extremely rounded, down-to-earth guy. And I think his psychological mindset is, you know, it's, I think it's perfect, but maybe that's also my problem because I think he's going to be very happy in his life. But
yeah, no, I don't matter what. Yeah,
yeah, but I don't know if that if he will unleash the his full potential. But yeah, I really like his approach to. And it's very superficial, the things I base it on. It's just, you know, the look in his eye, or, you know, the few conversations. It's very little, but I have a strong feeling that Prague is just very down to earth, and he's definitely able to extract only the positives from you know, the situation he's in, and from the all the fame and potential pressure and support. I think he takes only the positives out of it, and doesn't really take any negative along.
Yeah. Well, the next a person that I find very difficult to assess, Alireza Firouzja. Well, in the eyes of Magnus Carlsen and many others, he's a very, very special talent with very unusual gifts. At the same time, he is not always totally predictable. How do you see his chances?
Well, I have a feeling that the Carlsen and Kasparov, they have that. I mean, I mentioned them now together because I think they share this trait in common. Maybe that also is a natural trait to develop, as if you are such a great player yourself, that you start thinking that everything has to follow a certain certain logic, you know, and that and is predestined in a way. I guess then they also think that, well, they were predestined to be great, yeah? So that sort of makes sense. And I have a feeling that with Alireza, he had that thing going where, you know, he saw the writing on the wall, yeah? That this is the, you know, like the little baby Jesus that's going to dethrone him, you know, from... and he has to kill him as an infant, or...
Yeah.
Or he decided not to. He decided to embrace him.
Yeah.
And he's going to now, you know, come...
Let's walk on water together.
Yes, yes, exactly. Well, I mean, Lord, rather let him walk on water, and I will stand by. And because, you know, I walked in water in the past.
Yeah,
I think he was ready to, like, okay, come for me, please. Like, here, I want to hand myself over to you, great Alireza. And he tried to hand himself over to him. Like, he lost to him some bullet match, 100 games. I think they played at some point.
Yeah,
which was a big deal for Carlsen. He picked the game where he's gonna lose to Alireza, and he lost. Congratulations, well done. And then he lost to him in the Banter Blitz Cup also, and gave the interview afterwards that, yeah, Alireza is so great. And also during the games already, he was saying, yeah, like, he was so good, you know. During the final game, he was talking about how good Alireza is instead of making moves, yeah. It's just, it was just very disturbing to watch for me, the whole thing. But then, you know, the thing is, Carlsen was so much stronger at classical chess that despite all of that, whenever they faced each other, Carlsen would just do very well. Also, because I think the difference between classical and bullet chess is much larger than Carlsen used to think at the time. He always thought that, you know, these games are all the same in some way, and because he's the best at everything, they are kind of same.
Yeah.
But then it turned out, you know, he's not the best at everything, and then it turned out no longer. And then I think it's clear by now that, well, you have bullet specialists, you know, you have blitz specialists, you have rapid specialists. You have classical specialists. It's all a little different.
Yeah.
But one way or the other, Alireza didn't deliver, let's say, on the Crown Prince promise fully.
Yeah.
And it just became one of the top players right now, who is, of course, you know, fascinating chess style, sometimes does some incredible things. It was very cool how he came, let's say, to play Nepo in Vaikanzai, played this knight c3, claimed he did it without any prep, and everything went his way. He just crushed Jan in a beautiful game quickly.
Yeah.
Definitely gifted, amazing player. I think Alireza, he is struggling a little bit to find the balance or to find the balance or the way with the prep, you know, the sync with the prep. It's very hard nowadays because if you prepare too much, you sort of lose inspiration somewhat because the prep goes so deep nowadays that you start seeing all this, you know, all the roadblocks and all the draws and everything, and it gets to you. And then, so he, maybe on purpose or subconsciously, he's trying to keep himself very fresh. He's trying not to go too deep into places. But then some places he's not too deep, you know, that's a problem. Mm-hmm. So he's kind of and that was the issue in last candidates. His opening backfired. Mm-hmm. He lost to Nepo out of the opening twice, pretty much, both times because he didn't either remember or understand the finesses of his own prep. And he lost many other games there. The openings just didn't work out for him. And I guess he was trying to learn from that, but it's easier said than done.
Yeah.
So
in general, you think he may surprise us in any game, but on the whole, not very likely that he will play for first, or?
No. Mm. I mean, he cannot surprise us in any game. I mean, he that's the thing. Like, by this point, whoever he beats, it's not a surprise at all.
Yeah.
I think he could surprise us by winning the candidates, for sure. Of course, he can win the candidates. That's not the question. It's just that we were promised that this is going to be the new Carlson. That was the promise.
Yeah.
So this hasn't happened yet.
Yeah.
But of course, he can win the candidates. No, definitely. He's one of the favorites. He is still one of the highest rated. He's had many victories to his name. He won the Grandchester. Very young, but also not too young. So experienced also, learned something from last time. No, definitely he's good enough to win, for sure. And he will try to win. But not the main favorite either, I guess. Yeah.
Well, which takes us to the veteran in the field, the number three in the world, Hikaru Nakamura, 36 years old, and in fact amazing. I think that the results that he had to get to here. What do you expect from him? I mean, he says that his main advantages or his main strength is that he plays without any pressure because he doesn't have any financial worries. But there's more to it than that, isn't there?
Yeah, of course. I mean, Bill Gates also doesn't have financial worries, but it doesn't win the candidates, right? So it's very nice. I mean, we saw what Bill Gates did, in his game against Magnus. So the financial worry is not the issue.
Yeah.
Of course, what Hikaru means, I guess, if you translate him, is that he means that he wasn't able to unleash his full potential, his tactical gift and his calculation abilities, because for so many years, his own high expectation and on himself and the financial burden that he carried was limiting his own chess, from flourishing. And now that is out of his way, he is able to flourish as a player. I guess that's what he means, and I guess that's the case. But at the same time, I don't think. I still don't fully understand. I mean, I understand a lot of things. Like, first of all, when I heard Kasparov was asked why Hikaru is doing so well these days in classical, and Kasparov said the game caught up with Hikaru, and he brought up a very good point that because of the modern engines and the way the modern prep goes. Hikaru's main weakness, which was always the opening, is become almost irrelevant because he's able to patch up his openings very fast and put in work easily compensate for let's say for the fact that he hasn't worked on openings for the past 10 years compared to Fabiano, and that is all very true. It's also very true that he keeps himself in shape by playing all the time online.
Mm-hmm.
That's also very valid. But that all that said, still, I still don't fully understand why that would be enough to be that high in the ranking.
Mm-hmm.
I think he doesn't play very much also, so we don't have a clear sample size. I don't know, I'm curious if he would maintain such high ranking, if he would keep... I mean, whenever he plays, he really delivers, so don't get me wrong. I mean, he played all sorts of events. He played very well in Norway Chess, which is a closed invitational, which is one type of event. He crushed the... Well, not crushed, but finished clear second, in the Grand Swiss, which was a tremendous achievement in an open format as well. He obviously does tremendous in Rapid and Blitz too, so he's proven himself in all the formats. So it's not like he has to prove himself or has to prove it to anyone.
Yeah.
But still, I don't fully understand logically from where he would be world number three right now. And I don't fully understand it. Like, he, of course, keeps himself in shape, but a lot of what he does is not too helpful. Yeah, I mean, a lot of the work he does is basically like a sort of entertainment on, you know, television entertainment kind of in his streaming. A lot of these like speed rounds are against very weak players, which absolutely doesn't give anything to your chess. Like it's just useless. Like playing, I don't know, 1200s is useless for any top player. It doesn't get you anything. It's you might as well just, you know, just do nothing. Play some other video game, because it's just, you know, you don't need to learn any new patterns. You don't have to keep yourself sharp. You just play on autopilot. So I think a lot of what he does is not should not contribute to his classical chess. And you know, at the end of the day, if you, everybody's talented, so work should make a difference. So yeah, I'm kind of, you know, very impressed with Hikaru's ranking, but I find it hard to to see him as a favorite in this field. And I would rank him still under Nepo, who won it twice, and Alireza, let's say, who of course Alireza clearly puts in a lot of work on chess recently, and you know, he prioritizes his professional, you know, chess, classical chess stuff. Yeah. So but of course, yeah, I mean, well, I mean, I would be shocked if Hikaru wins the Kennedys, though. I mean, I really like him as a, you know, I respect him very much for what he does. And we know each other for years, and, you know, I don't want to be mean or anything. Like, I'm a big fan of Hikaru. Yeah. But just objectively speaking, like, I just don't sort of see, like, why it would be that Hikaru suddenly now would win the Kennedys. Like, of course, he has no pressure, but, you know, he was, at some point, he was younger, more motivated, more hardworking. And he didn't manage that time to win the candidates. I don't quite see why that would happen now, but okay. Chess, of course, as you know, it's all also a matter of circumstance. And with a little bit of wind your way, yeah, he's definitely within, you know, within the range where with a bit of wind in the back, he can win anything.
Yeah. Well, could it be that he's doing so much dreary work, like while playing blitz against very, very low-rated opponents, that this almost feels like a holiday if he goes to a serious tournament where he can do what he, well, loves most, maybe?
I don't know. I'm also not hard to say. I don't think he loves classical chess most. I don't think he would love, like, playing candidates is like a paradise for Hikaru. Okay. I don't think that's what his paradise looks like. I think he loves, like, blitz chess mostly, right? He played it all the, like, as a youngster all the time, and, like, that's probably what he loves more.
Yeah.
It would be amazing, of course, for chess if Hikaru would, well, I mean, it would be kind of, yeah, really, really cool, you know, for if Hikaru wins the World Championship title, because he's, like, already such a big chess personality on YouTube as well.
Mm.
It would kind of be, you know, it would merge the two worlds, like the chess YouTube and the top chess.
Mm-hmm.
It would merge them into one. There would be one king across the entire chess universe.
Yeah,
it
would
be fun.
It would be massive, yeah.
Yeah, it would be huge.
Yeah. So, well, that takes us to the top seed, Fabiano Caruana, who in the eyes of many experts are seen as, well, the biggest favorite, and there's good reason for that. How big of a burden will that be, that he is, well, maybe the most outspoken favorite?
I don't think it's a burden for Fabiano. You know, when he won six games in a row, there was a lot of pressure on him winning the seventh, but he won the seventh.
Yeah.
So I think he doesn't mind that, that kind of pressure, the positive pressure.
You're referring to his Sinkerfield streak of seven wins.
Yeah, exactly. Fabiano, you know, usually he had good periods where he would win stuff, and he had some few bad periods where he would not win stuff, and now he's in a period where he wins stuff.
Yeah.
So logically, he should be having good chances. But if you remember well his candidate tournaments, he's always well prepared, of course. But it's not always going smoothly. He's the way he plays, of course, it is he's very maximalistic, so he takes a lot of time. He ends up sometimes in time pressure. And then often he misconverts wins. If he doesn't convert wins, then of course he builds up certain frustration. I remember many tournaments where Fabiano plays and he has like winning position every second game. He doesn't win them. Even Canada's 2016 was like that. And then the candidates where 2020 was like that. 2021 was like that. Choose one candidate. Maybe some others. I think one he did quite well without winning. The one where he played final game against Karekin, who Karekin won at the time. So I think there he did well. Or actually that was 16. Yeah, but he was struggling at the first half there. And then he caught up speed. But I mean, I could easily see Favi also struggle. Because, you know, his play is not like very easygoing, yeah? Mm-hmm. It's some great prep and then hard work behind the game, behind the board. And sometimes it works and it's the machine just wins everything.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes it also is... it's a machine, but it just sort of doesn't win stuff. But just kind of... Yeah, it's kind of heavy the way he plays sometimes. And it's... Mm-hmm. Yeah, he needs to... I think he needs to, you know... to break loose to win a game somewhere at the start. If he wins the game early on, he will catch momentum. It'll be hard to stop him. Yeah. And if he doesn't, he sometimes gets stuck in that mode, you know? I've seen him, like in Vikanzai also, because he's such a great player, he will always, and he's also well-prepared.
Yeah.
And he's well-prepared because he works always hard. So it's like, he is always well-prepared, like for every candidate. There's no, it cannot be otherwise. He will be well-prepared.
Yeah.
So he will, and he's very strong, so he will naturally generate chances. That's also a given. Fabiano will have winning positions in the candidates. Like, I mean, I can bet on that. There'll be many winning positions. So the only question is, like, will he convert them and win the candidates, or will it be one of those events where he, you know, where he gets good positions, but somehow it just doesn't work well? Because that's also a scenario and a kind of mode where he sometimes enters. So we'll see. Of course, he's the biggest favorite. If you have to, like, you know, pick one, only one player, then of course Fabiano is the favorite. But I guess already if you if let's say, well, of course it's not Fabiano against the field, that's obviously not. The field is a huge favorite against one Fabiano, but also I think, let's say, if you take already Nepo and Alireza, maybe together they're also more likely to win than Fabi alone. Yeah, so I wouldn't give him some insane chances, but he's still, you know, I would still put his chances ahead of both Nepo and Alireza and also Hikaru, like, separately.
Yeah, well, the winner will play against Ding Liren at the end of the year. If we look at it from that perspective, who would be the most interesting opponent for him to get a great match?
Yeah, Ding has to recover, of course, it's clear.
Yeah.
Ding has to recover.
Suppose he...
It would be, of course...
Suppose he recovers.
Yeah, one thing that could spur some life back into Ding is Nepo.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, he's watched that movie and it had a happy end.
Mm.
So maybe he will like that again, to go through that whole thing where... he struggles because, you know, he had that already, you know, he struggled and then there was Nepo and then he won. So maybe Nepo would sort of motivate / inspire him to do it again.
But that's what he told me that he hopes will not happen, because he would be more inspired by another opponent.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Wow. Interesting. Well, I don't know if... I'm not sure he knows, you know.
What he's asking for.
He knows better. I think I know better. I know better what he wants than him.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, get your point. Yeah.
I'm joking, of course. I'm joking. No, I have no idea. So I would really like to see Ding back on his high horse.
Sure.
For sure.
Yeah.
And if he says he doesn't want to play Nepo, okay, he, of course, yeah. Then don't. But it was my thought, let's say. I mean, Fabi, I think it's just a very tough. I don't fancy Ding's chances. Like, even playing Fabi in a match is not.
No picnic.
Yeah, especially in a match. Because in a match, if Fabi doesn't convert, it's okay. It's still, you know, equal. You have to beat Fabi. And how are you going to beat Fabi when he's going to prepare tough, open, dry openings with black? And when Fabi wants to be tough and dry, we already saw what happened.
Yeah.
Even Carlsen got nowhere, like, absolutely nowhere.
Hmm.
Carlsen's chances in the match against Fabi, I think they were only the ones where Fabi, you know, left himself open with white when he was going for it. When Fabi wants to be solid, like, what can you do to Fabi, really? I don't think Fabi is something Hikaru would be kind of fun for Ding to try play against, because he's, you know, he's a little less sort of professional in a way. He's a little less meticulous in his prep, so you have more openings to poke through. yep. with Hikaru. You know, Hikaru just wants to get a position and play it. Mm. He doesn't try to close his entire repertoire, make it all watertight. Yeah. So Hikaru gives opportunities to play, so Ding would probably not mind that.
Mm.
Yeah, everybody, of course, would enjoy playing Alireza.
Yeah.
But it's not easy. Alireza is strong.
Yeah.
And the other less likely players to win, but still, of course, yeah. I guess facing a youngster would be always very interesting. A match between a youngster and Ding is very interesting because you have the generational clash.
Yeah.
And Vidit, he once had an interesting match with Ding. I think he beat him in that World Cup match. Yeah, I think Ding. Yeah, I think Vidit beat Ding. Or did he? Sorry, no. I think he maybe lost that match. He was about to beat him. I don't remember. But there was a match, World Cup match between Ding and Vidit, which was very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
I think it was in Georgia. I remember I was walking with Vidit and he was playing that match. Mm-hmm. I don't even remember how it ended, but it was very, very exciting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and okay, of course, Ding's favorite opponent is Nijat, but yeah, this is all not too likely to happen. Yeah.
Well, let's finish with the predictable question, Anish. Do you have a personal favorite? I mean, for chess reasons or for private reasons, I mean, who would you like to see as the winner?
Well, I'm closest on personal level with Vidit, of course.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd be very thrilled to see him win. That mm-hmm. would be amazing. It would catapult me to one of the most successful trainers of all time. I will immediately requalify as and say that, you know, I have always actually been a part-time player, part-time trainer. I was like Vidit's trainer, and mm-hmm. this is my, you know, he's my biggest student, and mm-hmm. this look what he has accomplished since we started working.
Mm-hmm.
So that would be nice. No, of course, because yeah, he's we're friends. Let's say. I mean, I'm very good terms with many other players. I enjoy occasionally a good conversation with Hikaru or Fabiano, particularly lately. You know, as we realized we have more in common than we thought earlier, because, you know, we are players of the same generation after all,
mm-hmm.
and we share, you know, similar approach to chess. So I like Fabiano in a sense, but of course we are competitors for the most part, so can't say, you know, that my heart bleeds when I see Fabiano lose or something like that. I cannot say that. So
no. but what were the things that you were surprised to discover that you were similar?
No, I mean, just the fact that we are of the same generation, and now there are so many different generations playing chess, you know, we belong to one group in a way. And we share the same approach to the game. We had the same coach for the most part. We worked with Chushlov.
Yeah.
Of course, you know, basically doing the same kind of things and sharing the similar vision for the game. Because you have a lot of other players who see the game very differently. The younger players or even the same age, but just so just work differently on chess and, work on different things than us. And I think me and Fabi, we are in approach. Of course, we are very different in chess style. And unfortunately for me, we have different level of accomplishments to our names. But, you know, in some approach, we are quite similar. So,
yeah.
Yeah, these are maybe the only two players that I would slightly select. I really like Prague, as I mentioned. Mm. I find him a very likable guy. I really, really like him.
Yeah,
Would be nice to see him as well. You know, if Gukesh would win, it would be quite interesting because then I would feel that, you know, the fight we had for candidate spot, you know, it had more to it than just the candidate spot. That would be also interesting. And as I mentioned, Hikaru winning would be... Yeah, huge.
So there's many options. How are you going to follow it? Are you going to do any commentating during the tournament?
No, actually, I was considering to do that. I like to do the commentary during these events because then I get to watch them, you know, from up close and you know, relive the event really from the inside almost. But it will be very hard now because they're playing from Toronto and I'll be staying home. So because I commentate when I do, I commentate from home.
Yeah,
I don't like to travel, you know, for commentary.
Mm.
And it's just not because I like very strict about my sleeping schedule. So I sleep quite early. So for me, it's not really possible. So I will, it'll be actually a big problem for me to watch. I really enjoy watching candidates. Okay, my favorite part of the game anyway is the opening. So I'll catch the opening. That's nice. Mm. But of course, I want to know how the games finish. I like the results as well. So yeah. I like the opening and the results. So I'll mostly be falling asleep. I'm not going to wait for the games to end. Mm. And it will, you know, I'll see the surprises in the morning. Actually, it's not a nice way to follow the games. In China, I watched Prague like that. That's kind of odd. Like, you know, you watch the games and then you go to sleep and you wake up and you have like a certain idea in your mind of what's going to happen, what would happen.
Yeah.
And you see this very weird results. Like, it's a bit weird. I'm not used to watch chess like that, but I'll have to. Yeah.
Well, let me thank you for all these insights, Anish. I think it was wonderful and really, really interesting to listen to your take on the various players and your hopes and expectations. So let's hope.
Thank you. I'd like to mention briefly because my take, it depends a little on my mood. So people should realize, like, whatever I say, like I say one thing today, I could say a different thing tomorrow.
Yeah.
So there's nothing like. I don't have like a clear. Also with these things, especially when it comes to chess players and top players, they're ever evolving. You know, as I see more games of the players, I change my opinion very much. So don't hold me, please, to my opinions. I'm just trying to share some of my thoughts. You know, and I hope they're interesting. But it's not like, you know, I'm. I can always change sides, you know, any moment. So don't expect me to, you know.
No. But it was just wonderful to listen to you while formulating your thoughts. And of course, I understood that, in the space of 1 hour, you were not going to provide us with encyclopedic knowledge that is all 100% waterproof about eight players. That would be asking a bit much. But it's been wonderful. I'm very grateful that. Accepted the invitation, and well, thank you very much for your thoughts, Anish.
Thank you, Durkan. Thank you for your time.